Margaret Goes Modern, a story. It's the show quilts that bore her the most during show and tell. All those elaborate medallions, all those persnickety mariners' compasses and their perfect points. Pointless points, Margaret thinks. Perfectly pointless points. And the dreary colors, as though the competition quilters don't want beauty to detract from their technical accomplishments. Bring on the mustards, bring on the browns and muted greens. Let me depress you with my palette. You're awfully fidgety tonight, Ruth Starnes whispers from the next seat over. Up front, a show and teller is unscrolling her quilt with the help of two assistants. Didn't you like the program? It was fine, Margaret tells her, though now she can't remember what the program was. Oh, the group that makes quilts for dog shelters. What had they called themselves? The Grateful Threads? She'd almost raised her hand to inform them that she'd seen Jerry Garcia in San Francisco in a coffee shop in 1968, and he had not only been high as a kite, but he'd also poured out the contents of at least a dozen sugar packets on his table, clearly finding it hilarious, and then left two pennies in his coffee cup for a tip. Not exactly a man Margaret would name her charity group after. She leans over to Ruth and whispers, "Do you think dogs really want quilts? Don't you think they'd prefer pillows? Or maybe beanbag chairs?" Ruth shushes her. "I want to hear what Gloria is saying," she says, pointing to the front of the fellowship hall where Gloria Reynolds is holding up a quilt applique with flower pots. Red flower pots, blue pots, lots of green vines snaking around the perimeter. "It's nice," Margaret supposes, "if you like that sort of thing." She used to like that sort of thing very much, but lately the applique patterns she sees in the magazines irritate her. All the pumpkins and sunflowers and little girls in sunbonnets. She wants to call up their designers and ask them what kind of dream world they're living in. "Okay," Margaret thinks, "I'm done." She reaches down beneath her chair to grab her purse. It was a gift from her oldest daughter, Susan. Expensive. Leather. Lots of buckles. "I'm going," she tells Ruth sotto voce. "I'm supposed to Skype with Maggie at 8:45, and I don't want to be late." "How does she like William and Mary?" Ruth asks, handing Margaret her umbrella. "Loves William, is so-so about Mary," Margaret says, and with that she makes her way down to the end of the row. Excuse me, sorry about that. And then heads toward the exit. It's Wednesday night, and the church fellowship hall smells like burnt coffee. You'd suppose they'd be able to do something about that, Margaret thinks. But she's 75, the veteran of a half a dozen churches and three quilting guilds, and no matter what, the fellowship hall always smells like someone burned the coffee. The Skype ringtone sounds a few times, a muted, flattened ring, as though it's underwater, and then suddenly Maggie appears on the screen. Maggie is Margaret's eldest granddaughter and one of her handful of reasons for getting up each morning. Margaret doesn't recall Maggie's father or his sisters delighting her the way this 18-year-old girl does, but then who has time to be delighted by her own children? There are moments, of course, mostly when they're sleeping, but the waking hours are so overlaid with busyness and worry that delight gets pushed out of the picture. "Hi, Grammy," Maggie chirps. "It's great to see you." "Hello, my darling," Margaret says. "You look marvelous." "I just got back from yoga. I'm so relaxed. I'm afraid I'm going to fall asleep as soon as I open a book." The conversation continues the way their weekly conversations typically do, with Maggie doing most of the talking and Margaret doing most of the adoring. This girl, her namesake, is the reward for all the years of diaper changes and after-school chauffeuring, for getting through Glenn's weekly speech therapy sessions, Susan's orthodontia, and Jenny's punk rock years. Margaret loves her other grandchildren, of course, but Maggie was the first, and she was the only for 5 years, and she's the sweet-natured girl that neither of Margaret's daughters ever were. "So, Grammy, guess what?" Maggie asks, her blue eyes wide, her voice still girlish, even though she's a college freshman now. "This girl on my hall has the coolest quilt. Her mom got it for her at Pottery Barn, and I was bragging that my grandmother made quilts, and she was like, 'That's so cool, you ought to get her to make you a quilt for your bed.' And I remembered that you said you would, but I didn't know what the style would be like here, so I wanted to wait. But now I'm thinking, maybe you can make me one?" "You know I'm dying to make you a quilt for your dorm room," Margaret says. "What colors do you want?" "Can I just show you the quilt?" Maggie asks, disappearing from the screen so that Margaret is left with a view of cinderblock walls and a poster that reads, "Keep calm and eat chocolate." "She let me take it off her bed so you could see it." "Of course, darling. Now you have to let me know if it's the colors you like or the pattern." "Kind of both," Maggie says, her voice muffled. Suddenly, the computer screen is filled with, well, something. Margaret can't quite make it out. A quilt, obviously, but what kind? "Do you think you could stand back a little bit?" she asks, "so I can get the full view." "Sure, Grammy," Maggie says from behind the quilt. "Let me just move a few things out of the way." As Maggie backs up, the quilt comes into focus. The only way Margaret can describe the pattern to herself is off balance. 4 rows of squares within squares, white, teal, orange, and fuchsia, each set of squares placed at slightly different angles from the others, 3 per row, though row isn't actually the right word as the squares aren't in a straight line. Strictly speaking, they're not, as far as Margaret can tell, blocks, but shapes set into the background fabric. "That's the kind of quilt you want me to make you?" Margaret asks her granddaughter. "With that charcoal background and the orange and pinks?" Maggie puts the quilt down and comes back to her computer. "And don't forget the teal," she says. "Do you like it? I just think it's so cool looking. It reminds me of modern art." "I love it," Margaret says, although she's not sure that she does. "I'll see if I can find a picture of the design online and get started on it first thing in the morning." "Oh, Grammy, thank you." Maggie claps her hands. "You're the best." Margaret shrugs. "Anything for you, sweetie. Does your roommate want one too?" "She's not here right now, but I'll ask her when she gets back," Maggie says. "That would be amazing to have matching beds." And then her exuberant expression sobers into one of concern. "How's Gramps today? Is he doing okay?" "Last I checked, he was in his study doing his math problems," Margaret reports. "I should probably go look in on him again, remind him it's almost bedtime." "Tell him I love him, okay? Remind him of that time we went to the zoo and I got so scared of the monkeys. I think he really likes that story." "Such a good girl," Margaret thinks after they've said their goodbyes. The minute Maggie turned 13, Margaret had worried and waited for the piercings, the tattoos, the foul language, the alcohol and drugs. But somehow Maggie had managed to avoid the uglier side of teen culture. Really, Margaret thinks, someone should give Glenn and Denise a medal. She rises from her computer, supposing she should go ahead and check on James, although she knows he'll be exactly where she left him before she sat down in the kitchen to Skype, in his study, at the architect's table he uses for a desk, his calculus textbook in front of him. The last time Margaret checked, he was going over Chapter 8 again, exponential and logarithmic functions. "Is it any easier this time around?" she'd asked him, and he replied, "A little easier this time. I think I'm improving." What he means is he thinks his brain is improving. He thinks he can fight Alzheimer's with math. Since his diagnosis this past spring, James has tackled algebra, geometry, and trigonometry. A retired history teacher, he believes that studying math will open up new circuits in his brain, plow through plaque deposits, and straighten out tangled wires. It could work, Margaret tells the children, who call more frequently since James's diagnosis, particularly Jenny, whose guilt at being a problem child for so many years rises up to the surface of every conversation. "You're nice now," Margaret tells her. "That's all that matters." But it's not enough for her youngest daughter, who sometimes calls as many as 3 times a week, to Margaret's annoyance. Really, how much is there to say? What she says to all of the children is, "Maybe your dad's plan will work. He seems fine. A little forgetful, but fine." But she knows the math is not working, and neither is the exercise or the dairy-free diet. Just yesterday, she'd found James holding a picture of his sister. "She's a pleasant-looking woman," he said. "Friend of yours?" Margaret pads down the hallway to the study, thinking about the quilt Maggie wants her to make. Is there a pattern for that sort of thing? Maybe she should go to Thimble Pleasures in the morning and talk to Sheila, who's so knowledgeable about quilt patterns. If Margaret can find a picture to show her, she's sure the two of them can figure it out. But she'd really rather have directions to tell her what to do. The door to James's study is cracked open, allowing a wedge of light to escape into the dark hallway. "Maybe it's time to call it a night, sweetheart," Margaret says as she goes in. "It's getting late." James holds up a hand to signal that he's in the middle of a problem. He's like a boy getting ready for a big test in the morning, Margaret thinks, and then shakes her head in irritation. "Stop it," she tells herself. She can't afford to get sentimental or maudlin. Jenny can wail and beat her chest. Margaret has to concern herself with the long run. A moment later, James shuts his textbook and turns around. "I'll wait until the morning to check my answers," he says. "But I think I finally got this stuff mastered. It's like learning a second language, you know? A new alphabet." "You should take up quilting," Margaret says. "You'd get the math and the movement at the same time. It's like a workout, making a quilt." "Maybe when I finish calculus. Or no, after that I'm going to do linear algebra. I have no idea what that is. Do you?" "Never heard of it," Margaret says. "But I'm sure it's interesting." "It's funny how I never liked math much as a student," James says, pushing himself up from his chair. "But now I think I get it. I mean, in a more philosophical way. A deeper way. I was thinking that for Christmas, one of the children could give me a Great Courses DVD on Einstein." "I'll mention it to Glenn the next time I talk to him," Margaret says, taking James's arm and guiding him toward the door. James looks at her, clearly confused. "Glenn?" Margaret doesn't let herself react. She takes a deep breath instead. She has read about what to do when your spouse forgets important people in his life. Reframe. Provide a historical reference. Don't make a big deal out of it. "Yes, I think Glenn would enjoy giving you that," she says. "Do you remember when he took physics in high school? Of all our children, he'd been the least interested in science, and suddenly he thought he was going to be an astronaut." James smiles, though there is a hint of panic in his eyes. He remembers who Glenn is now, but he's clearly alarmed that he forgot, if only for a moment. Margaret squeezes her husband's arm. "Who knew that he'd be a doctor instead? And a foot doctor at that." "He always did like shoes," James says, and Margaret smiles. "It's their old joke. She hopes their jokes are the last thing to go. "You're going modern on me," Sheila says the next morning, as she looks at the pictures Margaret has printed out from the internet. Most of the quilters who come in wanting to make a modern quilt are under 40. Margaret raises an eyebrow. "And you're saying that I'm not?" "Sorry, it's just that everyone I know under 40 has at least 3 visible tattoos, and I don't see any ink on you."
"And you never will," Margaret says, following Sheila toward a wall of solids.
"Can you imagine at my age?"
"What, 39?
"Exactly." Margaret has never used many solids in her quilts, and standing in front of the wide array of fabric now, she's surprised by the number of incremental variations within each colorway, even the whites, of which there are 5. "Which pink do you think is the right pink?" she asks. "The raspberry or the hot pink?"
"I'd go with the hot pink," Sheila says, pulling out the bolt from the wall.
"The brighter the better, especially if you're going to use a darker gray for the background. At the guild meeting, you see a lot of intense color, a lot of really shocking fuchsias."
"At the Peacemakers quilt meeting?" Margaret can't think of the last time she's been shocked by color at a meeting. There are a few quilters who are ambitious in their use of batiks, it's true, but she can't think of when anyone's use of pink has surprised her, much less caused her alarm.
No, the modern quilters meeting. They've started an alternate meeting every 3rd Sunday for the people who can't make their Tuesday nights. They've got a meeting this coming Sunday, as a matter of fact. You should come, now that you're into modern quilts. Seriously, the meetings are a lot of fun. It's a different sort of group."
Sheila pauses to smile. "Lots of ink." After they pull the fabric, they sit down at Sheila's computer to work out the measurements so they'll know how much to cut from each bolt.
"Now, you get the idea of these squares within squares, right?" Sheila asks. "You start with a square. Well, it's not really a square, is it? Let's call it a wonky square. And then you sew a strip to each side."
"Also wonky?" Margaret asks. The word feels strange in her mouth.
"What was that movie?"
"Oh, Willy Wonka." It had been Ginny's favorite, but Margaret had found it stressful. She'd been so sure someone was going to fall into that chocolate river, and she'd been right.
"No, but of different widths," Sheila explained. "And easy as pie, you've got your square within a square. And then you have to set it into the gray fabric."
Sheila goes on to explain how to construct the rest of the quilt. And Margaret realizes it won't take more than an afternoon or two to finish the top. And then she'll have to make a second one for Maggie's roommate. She wonders if her long armor Kate has some space next week. In the picture, the quilting is all straight lines. Nothing to it. "I suppose I could quilt it myself," she says out loud. "It seems fairly simple."
"Come to the meeting on Sunday," Sheila says. "One of the members is talking about how to quilt a modern quilt. It can be a fairly straightforward process, but there are some tricks. Besides, I think you'd like the group."
Walking out to her car with her bag of fabric and thread, Margaret wonders if that's true. She supposes it might do her some good to spend time with young people. Her life is filled with old people. Old people at her guild meeting, old people at church, old people in the doctor's office. And it has its fair share of middle-aged people as well. Nowadays, when her children call, they lament about their failing eyes, their upcoming colonoscopies, their knees. They're shocked by the decline of their bodies. Susan, in particular, feels betrayed. Like every pretty woman Margaret has ever known, Susan thought the gods of aging would pass over her, leaving her unscathed. Sometimes, when she's listening to Susan talk about the bags under her eyes or her sagging neck, Margaret goes into the bathroom and looks at herself in the mirror.
Her face is a collection of lines, a map of brown spots. "But at least I've got my own teeth," she always thinks. And then Susan asks, "Mom, why are you laughing?" End of part one. Tune in next week for part two of Margaret Goes Modern. Thanks for joining us on the Quilt Fiction Story Guild podcast, a production of Milton Falls Media, Incorporated, all rights reserved. Until next time, this is Frances O'Rourke Dow. Thank you for joining us.